Good afternoon. Welcome to the panel, RNZ National. I'm with Nalini Baruch, who is the founder of Lot 8 Olive Oils, and Patrick Smatty, the editor and co-founder of Business Desk. Quite a bit of response regarding social media. Social media says someone is depressing me. I agree with Patrick's point of view. I'm so sad that people I like are talking such a lot of misinformation. I don't know what to do. Wallace, I'm a fan of, I'm a Rolling Stone fan, but Devo's version of Can't Get No Satisfaction is way superior, says Tony. So your favourite cover versions, keep them coming. You can text us 2101. Albeit sewage overflows to beaches, campylobacter issues, or sewage bubbling into streets, water has become a major issue. And today it was announced three waters reforms will be mandatory for councils as the legislation moves ahead. Management of the water assets would be taken out of the hands of the country's 67 councils to four large water entities, with the aim of providing better water services around the country at a lower cost. Now, what are the three waters? They're about the three main types of water infrastructure: stormwater, drinking water, wastewater. Local Government Minister Nanaia Mahuta said it was unacceptable that every year around 34,000 people in Aotearoa fell ill from drinking water, and thousands of households were required to boil their water to drink it safely. So to discuss, first up is Claire Edmondson, the General Manager of Infrastructure NZ. Claire, kia ora.
Kia ora, Warren. How are you?
Good, thank you, Claire. It's become quite the divisive issue, hasn't it, this afternoon, or and indeed before. Are you surprised by that?
Oh, no, I'm not. You know, we've been hearing a lot of divisive, you know, commentary over the last few weeks as well. So, no, I'm absolutely not surprised by it. So,
So transferring responsibilities from councils, a key part of what they do by force. Is this undemocratic? Is this a real loss of control for local councils?
Well, I don't think it's about whether it's democratic or not. I think it's about government intervening to address failure and to ensure that the system is fit for the future. What is clear is for many years, as a nation, we have failed to invest properly in our pipes, our treatment plants, and other three waters infrastructure. And I just don't think that can continue.
So, some cities, like Wellington, have failed to invest. Others, like Auckland and the Kapiti Coast, they have spent a huge amount of money upgrading. Are they the ones that will lose out in this deal?
No, I don't think anyone will lose out in this deal, whether you're a large council or you have invested like Auckland Council. I think what's clear is that even the larger entities will be able to provide, you know, better services to their communities, which is their ratepayers and households ultimately.
Before we go to our panelists on this, can I just ask you, Claire, have we indeed spent many, many years not investing in what's under the ground?
Oh, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, there's been multiple reports over the last couple of years that have come out that have been peer-reviewed by experts that say that addressing the infrastructure deficit and upgrading these assets are going to cost between $120 and $185 billion over the next 30 years. And it's going to be possibly more if we factor in strengthening the system for earthquakes and also making sure we're resilient around climate change. And councils, as I say, just cannot afford that level of investment.
All right, $185 billion plus over the next 30 years, not small money. Nalini, you first.
No, it's not small money. Claire, a question to Claire. Why is it that we've had this lack of investment over those years? And how is it government thinks that it can now change all of that? How is centralisation going to change that?
I think the government has had to centralise. You know, I think, as I say, it's because of the fact that the council haven't done it, you know, and I think that some of that comes back to the politicians investing in stormwater, wastewater, treatment plants is not great. It's not something that you can cut a ribbon on and open it up, you know. So I think that's why it has been underinvested in, and it's been done over a long time, you know.
Patrick.
I've spent far too long thinking about this issue to be able to be crisp about it, I suspect. But I have followed these reforms right from the word go. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about today is that Nanaimo Hutu was first Minister of Local Government in the Helen Clark administration in the first decade of this century. And she locked onto this issue then and regarded it as unfinished business when Labour won or formed a government in 2017. And if you think back to 2017, one of the big issues of that election campaign was fresh water and its quality and the ability to swim in rivers and so forth. That was the Greens' big pitch in that campaign. I think that issue has kind of gone off the boil a little bit, even though I'm sure that if you ask New Zealanders, they would say they care about it. There are probably other things they care about more or more top of mind now. But it's been that underlying concern for the quality of both drinking water and the water that flows out of wastewater systems and into the sea from stormwater that's driven all of this. And an awful lot of focus has ended up being on how much is it going to cost and what's the right way to do it. There's no right answer to that. I don't believe the numbers that the government's produced about what it's going to cost. All we know is it's going to cost a huge amount. And we know that local government can't afford it. And we know that there might be any number of ways that you could put together these entities in such a way that they would be more efficient. The government happens to have chosen 4, you could have done 10, there's all sorts of different ways of doing it. Somebody had to make a decision, and Nanaimo Hutu hoped that she would be able, with a bit of nudging in the form of billions of dollars of promised central government funding, to help do the investment over the longer term, as long as councils agreed with this approach. They haven't agreed with it, so she just decided, well, we're going to do it anyway. And I think it's a big political gamble. But I think in the end, I broadly support it. I think the biggest problem they're going to have is that the Māori co-governance is triggering all the people who hate the idea that New Zealand might sometimes be called Aotearoa.
Before we go, Claire, because we've got a mayor who is not for it, Claire, let me ask you a question. Do we know how will water pricing be set?
Well, I think, as I think, the devil's in the details. So I think water pricing will be set by the regulator. Minister Clark's just announced that he's going to look at having an economic regulator around water pricing. But I think, however, the proposed reforms anticipate a cost between a range of $800 to $1,640, depending on your location, which is compared to being between $1,900 and $9,000 over the next 30 years. So that's got to be good for households.
Claire, good to have you on the program. Appreciate it. That's Claire Edmondson, the General Manager of Infrastructure NZ. Quite a bit of response to this, actually. What do you make of this three waters reforms, the three main types, stormwater, drinking water, wastewater, all to be centralised, taken out of the hands of the country's 67 councils? And speaking of councils, we have the Whangarei Mayor, Cheryl Mai, with us. Kia ora, Cheryl.
Kia ora, Wala.
And Whangarei Council was the first to opt out of the reforms. Why didn't you support them?
We made that brave and bold decision in June of last year, basically because I've been hearing all of the comments around the poor quality of infrastructure. And fortunately for us and for our ratepayers, Whangarei has been a really good guardian of all of the pipes and infrastructure that go with drinking water, wastewater. We've got some catching up to do with stormwater. I think everybody does. So over the years, we've made some really good investment. We've actually just commissioned a new water treatment plant. We've got reserves. We're not in debt. So we're a bit of an outlier. The minister spoke of some councils who don't have the income to meet the needs. We're certainly not one of them.
Okay, so this goes back to the question of those who actually have put a bit of investment. But, you know, your district council stands to gain, apparently, over $130 million from the government, which includes significant deal sweeteners for them to join its three waters reform. What's the downside? Hand it over to central government. They can do the hard work.
I think if I put that to our ratepayers, you know, would you want some money and lose the local control of these assets, or continue as we've been doing? The majority of people that I bump into are saying, don't let these three waters go from our control. They really want that local democratic oversight of these assets. So I think even with the enticement of, 130 odd million, mind you, we'd have to give back the reserves, so it comes down to 90 million. I don't think that's enough. Okay. We've got $1.2 billion worth of assets. Is it fair to give that over to another person, another entity to control?
What do you think, Patrick?
Look, I think I take the point that Whangarei has, like a number of places, done a good job. And so the case for Three Waters reform is not strong for a council that's actually done what it needed to do. There are a lot of councils around the country, though, where their ratepayers are saying exactly the same thing, despite the fact that the council's made a complete botch of the thing intergenerationally for all the reasons we've just discussed, which have largely, I think, to do with the fact that underground infrastructure is very expensive and you don't notice it until it's not working anymore. It's not as exciting as a library or a park or something, so it doesn't get done. I don't think there's any right answer here. I do think that what the government is proposing will hopefully mean that the very large costs involved are spread across generations better than they would otherwise be, and that they won't be as expensive as it would otherwise be for householders.
Nalini?
Just exactly what the balance is, I'm not sure.
A question for the mayor. Have you spoken to your rural dwellers? Because I'm a rural dweller and I have concerns around things like whether we have been consulted enough, whether Wellington will tell us how to manage things that we are already managing. Like, for example, where I am, there's 11 of us and we own our own bore. We maintain our own bore. We've just invested $24,000 to upgrade it. Is Wellington now going to tell us that's not enough? And are they going to try and take over our asset as well? So what about farmers with rivers running through their farms? Are they going to be told by Wellington what needs to be done and at what cost?
That's a really important point that you make, Nalini, because there are many people, even in my district, who are catching their own water from the roof, and they're on septic tanks, and they look after their own assets. And is the regulator going to have control over that? Only under the proposal, only if you're supplying more than two households. You then become a supplier, and the regulator will be making sure that your supply is fit for drinking and that you're complying with wastewater measures as well. So you're right. There are a lot of people in New Zealand who are not on reticulated supply, and the question is, how much control does Wellington want over that as well?
Just finally, let me get it quite clear before you go, Cheryl, who is the Whangarei Mayor, Cheryl Mai, that your three waters, your stormwater, your drinking water and your wastewater in Whangarei is A grade.
We comply with all of the requirements. We're compliant with our drinking water standards, unlike other councils. I accept that there is a problem for some councils. And really, it's that co-investment that is required, I would say, from our partners in central government. I think a better option is to look at how we fund it. But yes, our wastewater treatment plants comply, and we've got resource consents, and we've got storage coming out our ears, we're in good shape.
Okay, all right, very good. That is Whangarei Mayor Cheryl Mai. What do you think about this issue? Here's one. Cities like Christchurch will be penalised for having good infrastructure and up-to-date outfalls and good stormwater systems in place. This will be the end of the Labor Green government. Mark my words. So it may well become political, as Patrick Spelly there suggested. 21 past four, the panel NZ National. Well, poor ventilation and crowded indoor buildings are risk factors for transmission of COVID-19. Earlier today, the government indicated that students in years 9 and 10 could return to school in Auckland on November the 15th, but there's more work to be done. It's a tentative date, but with the plan for more students to return to school, do our schools have adequate ventilation? We talked with Hayley Milne yesterday, principal of Kia Aroha College, who cited poor ventilation as one of the reasons not to open just yet. That was that school. With us now is ventilation expert from Jackson Engineering, the managing director, in fact. His name is Lance Jamison. And he helped design the negative pressure systems for Green Lane Hospital during the SARS outbreak of 2002-2003. Lance, welcome.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Interesting trouble. How do you measure whether ventilation in a space is effective? So you walk into a classroom, how do you measure it?
Well, funny enough, the best measure is actually your nose. When you walk into a place, if it's poorly ventilated, you can pick it up immediately. When you've been in the space for, 20 or 30 minutes, you get used to it and you don't notice it. So, but if you want a better measurement than your nose, and there isn't much better to be fair, but we measure CO2. And what we're measuring there is a surrogate for oxygen. Oxygen itself is quite hard to measure. So we measure CO2 as a surrogate. So a lack of oxygen means a more CO2 is present. So if you look at ambient CO2 in the general air, it's about 400 parts per million. And we measure the air in the room. Once it exceeds about 700 or 800 parts per million, we want to introduce a higher level of ventilation. And just to round that out, if you're CO2 in the room gets above about 1,000 parts per million, you might as well all go to sleep. Most of it will be anyway. And that happens quite frequently.
Really? Goodness gracious. Now, NIWA, they're going to be working alongside the ministry on a plan to roll out, more CO2 monitoring with strong safeguards around the data of it. They want really good sort of data. But how do you think the air quality rates or the ventilation rates in New Zealand school classrooms?
Look, data I have suggests that we're out of spec. And by out of spec, it means we're not meeting the minimum standard of the New Zealand Building Code.
Oh.
But we're out of spec at about 60% of the time during the day on a typical classroom on average.
That's a concern.
Not a good result.
It's
a concern, which is interesting that it's come to the fore now, because it's just as big a concern for the education of our kids. Because when CO2 levels are too high, people's concentration levels drop off, they feel drowsy, and their ability to learn, which I think is what schools are there for in the first place, that's very much compromised. So, but one good thing that's come out of the pandemic, it's put it on the radar.
Well, Nalini, your questions or thoughts on this?
Lance, I'm keen to know whether that 400 parts per million, that's throughout the country, or whether we've taken city schools and not rural schools.
400 parts per million is about, it's a very good level of air quality, and that would exist in a rural area. If you want to head into downtown Auckland, it's probably 450 or above. Mm-hmm. So it is relative. It's quite a relative measurement, and it does depend on the level inside, depends on your starting point with the outside air. So we can't do better than that.
Patrick? Patrick.
That's right. I always thought that my tendency to go to sleep in the afternoon was to do with a combination of boredom and lunch. But now I understand.
Now you know.
In fact, it was all these people breathing around me. Damn
it.
I have to say, it strikes me as a sort of the opposite of the old New Zealand thing of if you're too cold, put on a cardi. Basically, if you want to ventilate your room, open a window. Go on, open a window. Obviously that will work, but it seems like quite a sort of an agrarian way of dealing with what sounds like a reasonably serious issue.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's any more obvious way to deal with it, though.
Well, here's an obvious way. Lance, what about, I want to bring up what they're doing in Germany. But first, someone says, why don't you just open the windows?
Well, it's hilarious, really, that we've gone through a bit of an evolution as a trade around air conditioning and ventilation, where we've made the systems more and more complex. Mm-hmm. And now we're grappling with the fact that we're struggling at times to bring in adequate outside air. Yeah. And architects are somewhat responsible. They build glass houses, which are brilliant for growing tomatoes, not so good for people to inhabit. But they're all sealed. Mm-hmm. And there is an issue with opening windows. It is the first thing to do. And fortunately, actually, it's more of a practical solution in a school than it is in an office building. If you're in the middle of Queen Street in a 20-story building, opening windows has other issues. not the least being the sort of dust and noise that comes in through them. But the limiting factor with opening windows is usually the weather. And trying to convince a teacher in a school to open a window when it's stormy and cold in Otago is probably a big ask.
Of course, yes. So, now, finally, there are some inexpensive innovations in other parts of the world. For example, in Germany, they have included using simple plastic pipes above each desk attached to a fan that requires occasional venting by opening a window. What do you make of that?
I think it's a brilliant idea. It's all about giving control to the people who need control. Now, students at a certain age, they can make that decision. But what they're doing in the UK, for instance, is I know they're rolling out about 300,000 CO2 sensors around the country into schools and classrooms. And they're using them very simply as an indicator for the teacher. Then when they hit a certain level, and I'm sure the level will be around sort of 700-800 parts per million, which is acceptable for longer term, as soon as it hits that level, the teacher gets a signal to do something. That something will depend on the classroom, but if you can open windows, open them. If you can't open the windows, then you're going to have presumably a mechanical ventilation system there. Make sure that's running. But if all else fails, you know, pick the kids up and take them outside for 10 minutes and leave them in the classroom that when they return, it's had a chance to recover.
Lance.
So there's some very practical things we can do.
Really, really interesting. And I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for that. Lance Jimison, all about ventilation. He helped design the negative pressure systems for Green Lane Hospital during the SARS outbreak of 2002-2003. Now, we've only got 60 seconds or so before the headlines, and I wanted to come back actually and pick up on something. Patrick, while you're here, bring your expertise in this Three Waters proposal, or this mandatory taking out of the hands of the council, the Three Waters assets infrastructure. How political, how much of a problem do you think it's going to be for the government? Because texts are coming through saying this is going to be a really real problem for them.
It will be a huge focus in the next few months. I think that the government is taking the view that they will win or lose the next election based on how they manage the pandemic, and that everything else is noise. I think that there are a lot of local body politicians who decided that they didn't want to go into this thing voluntarily because it's much easier to blame the government for doing this. And I think an awful lot of misinformation will be thrown around. I mean, these are not being, they've been taken off council balance sheets, but councils will still collectively own them. The big issue will be what degree of influence can they have over how they deliver local services. So I don't think it will be the end of the government, but I think it will be a hell of a lot of heat and noise around this, and it won't go away quickly. And it could well still be an election issue, a local body election issue, and could drift into the following year. But I think that there are bigger fish to fry for the future of this government.
You're on the panel, RNZ National, Patrick Smalley and Nalini Baruch with me this afternoon. And to come on the program, in fact, in about 3 minutes' time, the best ever cover of a song. Text them 21 01. It's time for headlines.